There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, the podcast that rounds up the very best bits from today's show, Tuesday, the 11th of February.
Let's get some more detail on one of our big local stories this morning, and that is the billionaire B.R. Shetty, who is facing increasing challenges with his empire in London. Well, it's based in Abu Dhabi, but it's listed on the London Stock Exchange. NMC Health is the hospital empire that he helped to build. Yesterday, they suspended him from attending meetings as the chairman, along with some other directors. They're investigating the nature of his shareholding. Now, the question arises, it's complicated. How many shares does he own in the company? Which you would think would be fairly straightforward. You either own Apple shares or you don't. Well, in simple terms, the complication arises from him owning the shares, but using them as a collateral for a loan. So, for example, if Tom owns 1,000 Apple shares, but then uses them as collateral to buy money from the bank and then uses that to go on holiday, who owns the shares? Is it Tom or is it the bank? Mm. And it's a much more complicated version of that that they're looking into. But for whatever reason, he is the founder of the company, he's the chairman, but he's not allowed to attend at the moment board meetings or indeed vote on the future of the organisation. You know the guy, you've worked with him.
I have, and he's a very personable guy, and I've had the opportunity and the pleasure of doing bits and pieces with him in the past, albeit not so much business, more media interviews, but also I used to work, obviously cricket is one of my great passions, and I did quite a few bits and pieces with cricket down in Abu Dhabi. And he's a great supporter. He's a great patron of cricket in Abu Dhabi and across the UAE, as he is with a number of philanthropic causes. Now, obviously, that's got nothing to do with the discussion point we're having at the moment. But from a personal point of view, I was always fascinated by his rags to riches story. I thought that was fascinating. Arriving in 73, setting up a very small pharmacy, and then going on to be one of the most successful businessmen in the region. From his philanthropic side, obviously a man who was involved in so many different organisations. From a recognition point of view, no shortage of awards in his trophy cabinet, recognition of the achievements down the years. So unfortunate story for him personally, but at the same time, you can't argue with the figures.
Well, you mentioned the third part of his empire, pharmacy there. He started off in pharmacy, then he grew the hospital business, and then got into financial services with UAE Exchange and then buying Travelex. And as recently as October, he was thinking about floating the third of those businesses, pharma, again in London. This was the headline by Bloomberg on October the 28th last year, about 3 months ago. Abu Dhabi billionaire B.R. Shetty may sell Neopharma shares, but I'm afraid that is completely game over at the moment. Comments from Abdullah Nahlawi, who's an analyst at Ras Mala Investment Bank here in Dubai, saying that the controlling shareholders of NMC, that's Mr. Shetty, have lost their credibility with investors. So the thought of another IPO is a very, very distant dream at the moment.
Just a little observation and a silly little aside as well. And I appreciate that Mr. Shetty and a number of his senior associates are probably going through some very trying times at the moment. But I'm sure there are a number of people also listening that picked up on a little point there, that if you got a message through from the powers that be saying, really sorry, you're not allowed to, you can't, we're not going to allow you to attend meetings for the forthcoming future, you'd be like, it'd be sort of silent cheer, wouldn't it, from within the car, going, oh, really? Okay, well, I'll just take that on the chin if I can.
High fives and victory laps. How to avoid
Richard,
a meeting.
You're not allowed to attend the weekly meeting, okay?
I would take that in a heartbeat. The one crumb of comfort, and you mentioned this, is that there are investors circling NMC to maybe buy it. Now, it all kicked off, just to recap, last middle of December, so again, not that long ago, when Muddy Waters, this short seller in the United States, raise serious questions about the financial health of NMC. They say their financial health is absolutely fine, but Muddy Waters raised questions. Then the share price was more than 25 quid a share. Today it's down at 7 quid a share. It's fallen 70%. So, of course, the private equity firms are circling because the fundamental business is still strong. We've spoken to Mo Yassine, an investor in Abu Dhabi, about this. He says, you walk into one of their hospitals full of patients getting really, really good healthcare from really good doctors and nurses, and insurance companies paying the bills on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. So the core business is fine. The problems are all on the balance sheet and in the boardroom. And that's why KKR, one of the world's biggest private equity firms, has officially registered its interest to potentially buy this company.
And from an infrastructure point of view, from a geographical point of view, I mean, they are amazing, very modern infrastructures. He's got a great share of the market down in Abu Dhabi and in other parts of the UAE. So from that point of view, it's certainly not a tired business that needs a huge amount of investment.
Other stories that we're covering today, Air Arabia, record profits announced yesterday of $1 billion. Even the chairman of Air Arabia acknowledged that they were challenging times for the aviation industry. How then did Air Arabia record A, a 15% increase in revenue, and B, record profits of $1 billion? We spoke with Adel Ali, the chief executive. This is what he told us.
It continues to be a tough year for everybody, and 2020 seems to be not much of a difference, but I think the we did what we've done every other year, just more focused, the team, you know, back on 2018 result, which was not up to the expectation of the shareholder. The whole team of Air Arabia decided to go for it, and we had a very, very tough objectives and targets and goals, and we just followed those. And everybody did everything they could to achieve the result, which we are thrilled with.
So in terms of a 15% increase in revenue, there's various ways you can do that. You could just do 15% more flights and that would increase revenue. But is it more than that? Well, Adel explained how they managed to boost revenue by 15%.
I think it was a combination of things. Of course, the revenue came as a result of a seat factor going from 81% in 2018 to 83%. So there was a 2% more people flew overall. And that we had an expansion of 11% of the overall capacity in the market available with the introduction of new routes. In addition to that, we also had a much better overall yield. The yield amounted to about 7% improvement. The combination of those three and the fuel was in our favor slightly. So all those made that result that we're talking about.
The final thing we spoke to him about was the coronavirus and the impact on aviation in general and Air Arabia in particular. They do have one route to China that they launched about 5 years ago to Ürümqi. Of course, that's not happening. Only flights to Beijing are leaving the UAE at the moment. That's not an Air Arabia decision. It's a Federal Aviation Authority decision. But more broadly, what has been the impact so far of the outbreak? This is what Adel told us.
I guess the quicker it disappears, the better for everybody. But so far it has not massively impacted us. Flight from east is slightly lighter. But if it continues, although we are not a big operator into China, I think it will cascade its effect into even some of the very busy routes that we all operate. We are seeing slight less people going to places like Umrah and so on because massive people and some people don't want to mix up. So corona is not a good thing for anyone, and I think the sooner it disappears is good.
Adel Ali there, Chief Executive of Air Arabia.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Now, Rich, I know that you're in the market for a new car, or have been in the last couple of weeks, so this might come of interest to you, because a Dubai-based car subscription startup has recently raised $1 million in a seed round here in the region. The UAE remains the regional hub for entrepreneurship, with more than 35% of the startups surveyed based in the country. We're going to have a closer look at that report in depth throughout the course of this show. But to that end, talk about their product, but also to talk about the challenges that startups are facing here. We've invited into the studio the co-founder and the CEO of Invigo. Eslam Hussain joins us live in studio. Thank you so much indeed for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
Really kind of you for coming on in. Now let's talk about the disruption, if we can, first and foremost. Give us the pitch, if you can, Eslam, on Invigo. What are you attempting to do with the market?
Absolutely. So today, one of the worst financial decisions anyone can do is buy or lease a car. A lot of people get very surprised with that, but for three main reasons. The time-consuming process to go from I want a car to I have a car, being committed to that decision from 3 to 5 years for it to financially make sense, and finally, the total cost of ownership on a depreciating asset is just ridiculous. Mm. But in our region, having a car, there is nothing like the freedom of having your own car to go on road trips with your friends, drop your kids to school, or even to go to work on time. So Invigo is not a rental, it's not a lease, and it's not a car loan. It's something completely new. So we allow you to get a car from a car dealership through a monthly subscription. You know what car it is, you know the mileage, the color. It's all through an app. So it's simple. You're not committed because it's a monthly subscription. You get to customize the subscription by having it a month, 3, 6, 9, decide is it full insurance, is it not. And finally, you get to upgrade your car every month, which is great.
So you're getting that variety. Is that variety part of the disruption that you're bringing to the market?
Absolutely, absolutely. So it depends on who you're talking to. The person that likes to drive a Range Rover for 3 months and then a Ferrari and then a Porsche, for him it's more about the ability to change. But for the person that's price conscious, it's about having control over your cost on a month-to-month basis.
Reaction since you've gone live with your co-founders and things like that, all good?
Yeah, it's been great. We have so far 650 active subscribers, so that's 650 cars in the past since we launched in March, so that's in 9 months. So it's really exciting for us. We're looking to continue growing, expand to Saudi and other regions in the market, or other countries in the region. So it's really exciting for us.
So to that end, I mean, how much of a challenge has it been for you? These things don't happen overnight. Obviously, this is something that you, your partners and your team have worked very tirelessly for. Is it still a good time for startups here in the region?
Absolutely. So I tell my friends who always say that they're proud and I don't understand why, but I tell them if it was 10, 15 years ago, and I'm 33 years old, if I walked into a room and said, hey, I want to disrupt the automotive industry, everyone would have laughed and like, all right, fine, let's see how you do it. But today we have, let's say, the recipe in the region to actually create a healthy and a successful ecosystem that can provide entrepreneurs the opportunity to be successful and hopefully achieve their dreams.
Why is the UAE, Dubai, or the UAE as a whole, such a good place for startups and for funding at the moment? Because this is nothing new. You know, there are so many sort of incubators out there at the moment. There's so many seed funding opportunities. What is it that has seen Dubai, the UAE, continue to prosper in this field?
So I think the most successful place on planet Earth is Silicon Valley. So if you compare Silicon Valley to Dubai, we're still not there, but the seed is there. So the first thing that makes a country or a place very successful for startups is to have a deeply interconnected ecosystem, which we are seeing happening. So what does deeply interconnected mean? So first, we need to have entrepreneurs with great ideas. The second point is we need to have highly skilled talent in every in every job at every company stage. Third, we need to build a community that allows these talent and entrepreneurs to share their ideas and pass knowledge around. And fourth, great universities. So there's a lot of universities around us that can supply great talent. And fifth, I think, which is the most important part, is successful entrepreneurs that have got an exit, that have an impact on the next generation that are coming, because they can see, oh, all right, Kareem has done it. All right, Souk has done it. So I can also do it.
What about the cash, though? Because that's the one thing. I mean, we talk about it on this show. We talk about it, you read about it in the media on an everyday basis, that times is tough here at the moment. Cost of living's going up, etc. And yet, you are still able to raise $1 million in seed rounds. Obviously, it wasn't straightforward. There's a lot of hard work that went into it. Is there still plenty of cash when it comes to seeding out there?
I think the region is still maturing up when it comes to VCs. It's taking a bit of time for them to understand, for angel investors to come in. But I think also the one great thing Kareem and Souk has done on other successful exits is that international players are taking the market very seriously.
Okay.
So it's no longer only about the local players and the local VCs. But
also you've seen that, have you?
Yeah. I mean, our lead investor is from Silicon Valley.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, so we've been lucky there.
So in terms of investment, investors from outside are now looking into the UAE more than they have done in the past?
Absolutely. I mean, Kareem's exit has made a great splash across the world.
Okay, let's say that consumers are convinced about this. Yeah, I'd love to rent a car by the month. I'm on your website. You can get a saloon car for a couple of thousand dirhams, SUVs, 4,000 dirhams a month. Fine. Where do you get your cars from?
So they're right coming from the car dealership. The one thing,
because they're not new, are they? I'm looking at the cars on your website. They're newish, 2017, 2018.
Yeah, so we have a variety. So it can be from 2020, 2019, 18, 17, depends on the availability, which is great because it gives the consumer the flexibility because all these cars are priced at a different price point. So you might be willing to pay less for a 2018 that's been driven for only 15,000 kilometers rather than get a brand new car. So it fits your needs. It depends on your needs.
But you're getting them from dealers. Yeah, it's not Tom's decided, okay, I'm sick of the whatever car it may be, I'm gonna hand it over to S7 and Vigo and they can drive around in my XYZ for a while.
No, it's right from the car dealership. So this is one of our other value propositions because the cars are maintained by them. They come with great quality. Some of them are brand new. So you're sure of the quality control that happens for the car before it goes out to you.
Eslam, best of luck with that. Appreciate you joining us this morning. Eslam Hussain, co-founder, CEO of Invigo. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. The Business Breakfast's Pick of the Papers.
We got producer Shruti Rajendran with us in the studio as well as Tom Urquhart. Morning, Shruti.
Morning.
Starting with this.
And the Oscar goes to Parasite.
Record-breaking day for Korean cinema and for non-English language cinema, but not for TV ratings.
No, so apparently the US live TV audience for the Oscars fell to an all-time low. So roughly 23.6 million viewers watched the awards ceremony, and that's according to ABC. Who have cited Nielsen's, the rating agency. And the rating fell sharply from last year when last year was 29.5 million people. And last year was the first time they did not have a host for the Oscars, but they had performances by Queen and, you know, that sort of kicked it off and, you know, people were into it. But this year, apparently, it's not done as well, but it still remains the most watched award show.
So, 20, how many million was it?
23.6 million.
Down from 29?
29.5, yes.
That's quite a drop, isn't it, Tom?
Yeah, I think it's a significant little story, that one, in terms of the eyeballs. And we were talking about the eyeballs yesterday and the impact that the Oscars can have on just the brand, not just of Los Angeles, but of the United States as a whole, and how can that can be marketed. What can we put it down to? Is it a waning of interest? Has it got anything to do with the sort of anomaly that we were talking about yesterday, that populist films just aren't recognised at these awards ceremonies at the moment? There's a lot more art house, or what's the phrase that they use in the business?
Indie?
Oscar bait, you know. Oh, we get directors. Yeah, it is exactly that. It's the sort of modern look at the directors and producers create films that will be recognized by the critics for the Oscars, and they release them just in advance of the Oscars. Whereas the majority of paying punters, either on downloads or, of course, going to the cinemas, are not watching those films compared to others. So maybe there is something of a discrepancy there. Will it ever take away from the glamour? I'm not sure if it will, but
you see, I've got a different view, and I don't think it's to do with what type of movies are at the Oscars. I think it's the fact that movies are being squeezed by the video games market, and you need a new audience, don't you? I mean, even in the United States, the half population is under the age of 40. They've been brought up with video games. It's just a bigger market.
Yeah.
It's worth more. People spend more money on it. They're more interested in Fortnite or whatever it may be, or Call of Duty. And that is where a lot of the action is.
And so the streaming market as well.
Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked yesterday about the fact that Netflix had more nominations than any of the movie studios. It didn't actually win that many awards, did it? But Robert De Niro and Al Pacino were both up for Best Supporting Actor, weren't they, for that dreadful Irishman thing. And they lost out to Brad Pitt in the end.
Yeah.
So the streaming guys are kind of muscling in on the Oscars.
Yeah.
But it's other things, other things competing for attention.
Hmm. It's competing for those all-important eyeballs. So maybe it just comes down to, because if you're looking at it from an audience point of view, people just aren't making appointment viewing these days. You know, people aren't going to say, okay, I am going to sit down in front of the Oscars this evening to watch it from start to finish. They will do as my 13-year-old son does and says, I'm not watching 90 minutes of football. I'll watch 5 minutes of highlights straight after the game. Thank you very much. When I want to watch it, I'll stream it at my own time.
I also feel like the lack of a host is a big issue.
I don't.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I, for the Golden Globes with Ricky Gervais, you know, I wanted to see that because I wanted to watch his monologues.
Yeah.
And I feel like when there's not that personality who's making the jokes, there's really no point watching someone winning an award, because like you said, I can look it up online and I can watch the speeches later. So I don't want to wait around. Like, for example, when Eminem performed yesterday, everyone was surprised because nobody knew he was coming on. There was nobody introducing him. Mm. So even the audience was surprised that Eminem came on, sang his song and then went. Nobody knew what he was doing.
It was
there.
A little disjointed, wasn't it?
Yeah.
A lot of confusion around a couple of the performances and a couple of the songs that were performed and a couple of the presenters as well that just weren't explained.
Exactly.
Thomas, to ensure that our children have a good education for the next 5, 10, 15 years, let the record state that it's very important to have a host at awards ceremonies. How many did you do last year?
I concur, Richard. I concur.
What, do you have like a tally?
I don't have a tally, no, but it was, it was a significant
amount.
You're
2 or 3 a week, are you?
Yeah. On average, 2 or 3 a week. And then during the busier times, you know, you can get through about, you can get through about seven a week at the busier day, at the busier times. You know, you can double up.
7 a week?
Yeah.
Do you ever mix them up and say, oh,
no, same old gags every single time.
Oh, but you know, in case you get one at lunchtime and then one in the evening.
Yeah. You do a couple of like that, you know.
The good old double dip.
At least you don't have to get changed.
Let's talk about tourism. Tom, you've got 2 tourism stories for the price of 1 this morning. You're cashing in your entertainer voucher.
I am indeed. Ras Al Khaimah, let's start up there if we can with the news from Ras Al Khaimah Tourism Development Authority. Yesterday caught my eye. They've got this. I know this is nothing new because it's been talked about for a while, but the official unveiling yesterday of the brand new Jace Adventure Peak. Now, we all know about the really scary long zipline thing up there. Now they've turned it into more sort of dynamic collection of attractions, all on top of Jebel Jais. So great for Jebel Jais, great for Ras Al Khaimah. I think great for the UAE as well as an alternative for adventure tourism, people coming into the country. It is now multifold because you've got the Jebel Jais flight, the Jace Sky Tour, the Jebel Jace Viewing Deck Park, you've got Jace Adventure Centre and Jace Sky Maze. So anybody called Jason will be heading straight there now and saying it's all about me. Up in the Hajar Mountains, obviously. It was officially unveiled by delegates, the rulers of Ras Al Khaimah and others yesterday. But I just think it brings a sort of new dynamic. One thing that I think is, because twofold. One, sort of your thrill seekers of a weekend who want to go up there, tourists who are coming over who want something a little bit different. But two, it's sort of cashing in on the rather lucrative team building market, because this Jace Sky Maze is basically like one of these, you know, obstacle courses that you find and the roofs of certain malls here in the region. They've just done it outside, about 10,000 feet above the ground, over suspended platforms, and you've got to get from A to B across a death-defying gorge underneath you by your team. But it seems to be very well organised. It's all being put together very well, and I just think it brings a nice alternative for the weekends.
I saw Sheikh Saud bin Saka al-Qasimi was there, the ruler of Ras Al Khaimah.
He was, yeah.
And he gets a lot of good press, because I don't know him personally, but I know a lot of people who have worked with him, and they say whatever industry you're in, whether it's tourism or trade or shipping or financial services, whatever it is, he's just very hands-on and very interested and very up for ideas.
Very pleasant. Now, yeah, I had the pleasure of doing some work with him for a tourism authority project 2 or 3 years ago. Could not be
nicer. Was it an award ceremony?
It wasn't an award ceremony. It was an unveil, an afternoon unveil. So there's probably an award ceremony in the evening. Afternoon unveil followed by a dinner. Might have been the odd award or something like that, but it usually is. But couldn't have been nicer, couldn't have been more attentive, and just wanted to talk about Sandhurst for hours on end.
10 seconds, QE2, why is that making headlines?
QE2 is not going anywhere. There has been some speculation that it would be moving from Port Rashid up to the new Palm Jumeirah area where they're building all sorts of harbours there. It's not. It's staying down at Port Rashid. It's going to go. It's going to be the centrepiece of Port Rashid. And it's been turned into what they're calling, and I hate to say this because I don't like to use the word hub. I think we overuse it here in the region. It's going to turn into a floating business hub. So question moving forward, do you see the QE2 as somewhere to go to do business, or is it more of a leisure getaway? I'm more of the latter, but maybe it could become a business hub. I'm not sure.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Size Business Breakfast.
The UAE Central Bank proposing new consumer protection laws. Mubarak al-Mansouri is the governor of the Central Bank here, and he says, through this process, we will move forward with the development of a new financial consumer protection regulatory framework to protect financial consumers. Joining us in the studio for some more insight on this is the financial services partner at the law firm Pinsent Masons, Tom Bicknell. Morning, Tom.
Good morning.
I'm going to ask you what we know about this. I also know your answer is not much, but what do we know?
Well, 2018, the central bank recast their key supervisory law, which to that point had been in existence since 1980. One of the key strands of that was that they would, underneath it, develop subordinate regulation dealing with consumer protection. So we know this has been in the boiler for a while, and we know it's needed in the market.
So you say it's needed in the market. What problem are they trying to solve?
I mean, I would take a step back and say the fact that there really isn't consumer protection for financial products sold by banks in any meaningful way at the moment is why it's needed. I think the problem is perhaps that when we deal with a lot of sales staff selling, say, credit cards, financial products, insurance through banks, there's perhaps a lack of rigor around how they deal with customers at the point of sale. There's probably not much in the way of qualification or experience requirements. So I think that's really needed that we put in place some standards that we see in other markets around the world.
Well, we do have some consumer protection for bank customers. I nearly fell off my chair about 2 years ago because I'd taken out a loan with the bank, and unbeknownst to me, they'd also given me a credit card that I'd never used, never opened. But I got a bill for about 5,000 dirhams several years later for interest and charges. Like, what's going on? And so I found this little, I don't know, section of the central bank website where you could complain or raise an issue. And I did. And they fixed it. And I got my money back. And honestly, I thought I didn't have a chance. It was against this huge, well-known bank. But I did. So we do have some consumer protection. What is there already there?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think you've got more of an informal complaint system, as you said, so that you can seek redress. And we know that we have that at a general commercial level, but also in the financial services level. There is also what's called the rules around selling insurance through banks, because this is not traditionally a core product of banks. So there are rules around how those are sold. But I think what we lack is something where if you and I went online to find some rules around how someone should be selling that something to us and what qualifications they should have and what they should be disclosing to you when they try and sell that, it would be hard to find something like that at the moment.
So the Central Bank of the UAE covers what we might call onshore banking, doesn't it?
Correct.
So that's my bank account, your bank account, most company bank accounts here in the UAE will be onshore UAE. So it covers most banking in the country, I would guess, doesn't it? Not DIFC or Abu Dhabi Global Market, but most other things?
That's right. So this to be basically to act as a dirham deposit-taking institution, which means basically to be a retail bank in the UAE, you would need to be licensed by the central bank. Yeah.
But what it doesn't cover is the savings and investment products that we buy. You mentioned the word insurance there, because that's covered by a different regulation. We did have new rules, didn't we, from the Insurance Authority and many, many others. Can you clarify that for us?
Of course. Yeah, in fact, that was the last time I think I came on here was to talk about those savings products. They're for the life insurance sector. So this is the sale of what tend to be quite complex savings and investment products, generally sold through insurance brokers. So this created a system of restrictions on, you know, commissions earned around disclosure, around point of sale, qualification requirements. The issue is that notwithstanding those products are not traditionally purely banking products, banks, because they obviously have the largest distribution network of most financial institutions, they are one of the primary means of distributing these products. So it's really shoring up that gap, because you can have a load of rules applying to insurance brokers, but if those products are then just being sold through the bank, you're missing out on having those standards apply at that point.
So even if I buy a 20-year savings and investment product through a bank that somewhere down the line is an insurance company in DIFC, these new banking rules and regulations we think will protect me?
I think so. They'll add the extra layer. You would always have recourse against the product issuer, which would be the insurer. But I think if someone sold you something in the circumstances you described before with the credit card, where you didn't even know you were buying it, certainly you would have redress against the person that sold, the institution that sold it to you, which would be the bank.
Tom, can I ask a quick question? And not, you know, fully understanding the regulations, etc. But one thing, observation I have, there seem to be a lot of regulators. Do regulators talk to other regulators or not? Or is there a sort of lapse in communication between them? Is that one of the problems?
You could, I think you could perhaps say, if we were talking about this 3 or 4 years ago, that has been identified as an issue, that there's been both regulatory overlap, but then gaps in regulation, and that would seem to suggest there hasn't been communication. We do know in the last couple of years there's been a kind of centralized forum set up, if you like, between all the main financial regulators, so the Ministry of Finance, Insurance Authority, SCA, and the Central Bank, to actually coordinate and communicate on these things better. I think also the DFSA is part of that, DIFC regulator. So I think the answer is we didn't, now we do have adequate communication.
Number of messages coming in. For example, Elan writes in with a specific use case. Elan says, my mortgage rate is variable. The bank is very quick to increase it when base interest rates go up, but refuses to decrease it when rates have gone down. What are my rights on something like this and other new rules likely to protect Elan and others like her?
I'm not sure they would get a consumer protection set of rules would go so far as to dictate how the pricing and the structure of a product such as a mortgage product, and in that the mortgage rate should be applied. There might be a degree of fairness to it, but I would say this would be more making sure that you understand that the terms of the product allow the bank to do that, and that you're clear on how that will affect your bottom line.
What are the main specific issues, if you look at global best practice, that these kind of regulations typically protect consumers against? What are the main, and choose my words carefully, what are the main things that banks do wrong that consumers need protection against?
I think with any type of product, financial products are inherently complicated. You know, we always get put in front of us 30 pages of terms. It's rare that most of us, even I have to say me as a lawyer, will look through those line by line. So I think it's making sure that whatever product terms are put in front of you, that there is some form of lucid short form guide to that product that your average consumer off the street can understand exactly what they're getting into. So the watchword there is making sure there's adequate disclosure.
20 seconds. What are the banks going to say about this? It's out for consultation.
I think they'll view it positively. As we were saying, we know it's something that is in place across markets globally. So they should view that as needing to adhere to international best practice. And I think it'll give them a framework to work within and sell their products better.
Tom Bicknell, partner at Pinson Mason's, a law firm. Appreciate your time.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.